A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been following the Miami cargo overrun, and he wants the machinery behind it. Not the headline, but what happens in the hangar afterward. He's asking three things. How did aviation build this forensic investigation culture in the first place? What exactly do investigators pull out of the black box and everything else? And then, how does a finding become a rule change? That last one is the part most documentary skip.
The pipeline. Because the report isn't the product, the report is the raw material. And Miami is a clean test case because it's a runway excursion, which has been on the NTSB's most wanted list for so long, it might as well have its own parking spot.
A cargo jet overruns the runway, nobody dies, and within hours there's a team on the ground treating the scene like a crime scene, where the victim is the aircraft.
And that's the thing Daniel is circling. The level of rigor. Most industries investigate a failure to find out who pays for it. Aviation investigates to find out what the system didn't know about itself.
So we start with the history, then the data, then the pipeline.
The Miami Go team is already there. The NTSB launched it within hours, and the first thing they did was a look for a culprit. They secured the recorders, the radar data, the tower transcripts, the tire marks on the concrete. They cordon off evidence before weather or cleanup crews destroy it. That instinct, that the scene is a document to be read, that took decades to build.
Which is the part Daniel flagged? How did we get here? Because in the 1920s and 30s, the investigation was basically a coroner's inquest with a propeller attached.
Right. Early aviation accident investigation was ad hoc. A crash happened. Some local official or a manufacturer's representative showed up, looked at the wreckage, and usually concluded the pilot was at fault. The pilot was dead, so he couldn't defend himself. It was cheap, it was fast, and it told the airline nothing useful.
The dead pilot is convenient silence. That's a grim foundation for a safety culture.
And the shift away from that's the whole story. It wasn't one law. It was the accumulation of crashes that made no sense under the scapegoat model. You'd have a perfectly competent pilot, good weather, a functioning aircraft, and the plane still went into a mountain. Blaming him didn't prevent the next one. So investigators started asking what the pilot was looking at, what the instruments told him, what the training had prepared him for. The unit of analysis stopped being the person and became the system.
When does the probable cause concept actually formalize?
Post-World War II, really. The war dumped a huge amount of engineering talent and instrumentation into aviation, and you had the Civil Aeronautics Board doing investigations with actual laboratories. But the big institutional moment is 1967. The NTSB is created as an independent agency. Crucially, it has no regulatory authority. It can't fine anyone. It can't ground an airline. That sounds like weakness, but it's the opposite. It means the NTSB's only power is the quality of its analysis.
An agency that can only tell the truth, and the truth has to be good enough that other agencies act on it.
That's exactly the design. And then there's the party system. This is the part that sounds insane to outsiders. The NTSB invites the manufacturer, the airline, the pilots' union, sometimes the engine maker, to participate in the investigation. Boeing investigates its own crash. American Airlines investigates its own crew.
Wait, the people who might be liable are in the room?
Under NTSB control, with NTSB leadership, and they aren't allowed to be adversarial. They provide technical expertise. The guy who designed the hydraulic system is the fastest person to tell you whether that hydraulic failure was causal or incidental. The union rep can interpret the cockpit voice recorder in a way no outsider can. It works because everyone in that room has the same long-term interest. If the investigation is wrong, the next aircraft crashes the same way, and that kills their passengers, their pilots, their product.
It's the opposite of a courtroom. In a courtroom, each side presents the version that helps them. Here, the manufacturer has an incentive to find the real flaw, because if they hide it and it crashes again, the company is dead.
And the party system has survived 50-plus years, which tells you it works. It isn't without tension. There have been fights over who gets access to what. But the foundational bargain holds. No blame, full access, everyone leaves with the same facts.
Which brings us to the orange box. Daniel asked what investigators actually pull. Let's kill the first misconception. The black box isn't one device, and it isn't black.
Bright orange, so you can find it in wreckage. And it's two separate units, the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. The FDR is the instrument. Modern ones track hundreds of parameters. Control positions, engine thrust, airspeed, altitude, heading, hydraulic pressure, flap settings, brake application. On a cargo jet like the one in Miami, you're looking at thousands of data points per second across the final minutes of flight.
So the FDR tells you what the machine did. The CVR tells you what the people said while it was doing it.
And what they heard. The CVR captures the cockpit audio, including alarms, stick shakers, wind noise, the thump of a gear retracting. The voice part is a rolling loop, typically the last 2 hours on modern solid-state recorders. The FDR keeps the last 25 hours of flight data. Solid state changed everything. The old magnetic tape recorders were fragile, and a crash could destroy the tape. Solid state memory survives fire, impact, immersion.
How long does recovery take in a case like Miami?
The recorders go to the NTSB lab in Washington. The data is downloaded, which can take days if the units are damaged. Then the real work starts. The FDR data gets synced with the CVR audio, with the radar track, with the tower transcript. You build a timeline where every second is accounted for. What was the airspeed at touchdown? When did the thrust reversers deploy? When did the brakes come on? What was the runway condition at that exact moment?
And the runway condition isn't just wet or dry. That's a whole forensic subfield.
Runway friction. The investigators will measure the braking coefficient on that exact runway surface in those exact conditions. They'll look at the tire marks. A skidding tire leaves a different mark than a rolling tire. The depth and width of the rubber deposit tells you whether the anti-skid system was cycling. They'll recover the brake assemblies and tear them down. A brake that overheated and faded leaves metallurgical evidence.
So the aircraft itself is a witness. The wreckage is testimony.
And it's perishable testimony. That's why the GO team moves fast. The NTSB has a list of accredited investigators on call, and they deploy within hours, not days. They'll be on the ground in Miami securing the scene while the foam is still on the runway. Because the first thing that happens after an overrun is someone wants to move the aircraft and reopen the airport. The investigators have to get there first.
What else is in the evidence pile beyond the recorders and the wreckage?
The full stack. Air traffic control radar data, which gives you the ground track and speed. The tower transcripts, which give you the clearances and the pilot readbacks. Surveillance video from the airport. Weather data, including wind shear alerts. The load manifest, because a cargo jet's stopping distance depends on its weight and center of gravity. The crew's duty records, because fatigue is always on the table. The maintenance logs, because a brake issue or a tire issue might have been deferred 3 flights ago.
So the investigation isn't reading one box. It's reconstructing an entire system state at the moment of touchdown.
And then the probable cause determination is a narrative, not a verdict. The NTSB will issue a report that lays out the sequence of events and identifies the probable cause. But probable cause in NTSB language isn't one thing. It's a chain. A wet runway, a tailwind, a touchdown slightly long, a brake that was within spec but at the edge of spec, a crew that had landed in similar conditions 100 times but never with this combination. All of those are contributing factors. The report names the chain.
The difference between that and pilot error is the difference between a post-mortem and an autopsy that actually tells you something.
And the case law here is full of examples. American Airlines Flight 191 in Chicago, 1979. The left engine separated on takeoff. 273 people died. The initial reaction was mechanical failure. The NTSB dug in and found that the maintenance procedure used to remove and reinstall the engine was flawed. American had been using a time-saving method that put stress on the pylon. The investigation didn't stop at the broken part. It found the maintenance culture that made the broken part inevitable. That led to sweeping changes in inspection protocols across the industry.
And the more recent example, Colgan Air in 2009. The public story was pilot error, full stop. The crew stalled the aircraft in icing conditions. But the NTSB report went deeper. The first officer had commuted overnight, was fatigued. The captain had failed multiple check rides, and the airline didn't have a system to catch that. The training didn't adequately cover stall recovery at altitude. The result wasn't just blame. It was new regulations on pilot training, on fatigue management, on minimum flight hours for first officers. The report names the chain, and then the chain becomes the to-do list.
Which is the pipeline Daniel asked about. And this is where the system gets impressive. The NTSB issues safety recommendations. They aren't legally binding. The NTSB can't force the FAA to do anything, but a recommendation carries enormous weight. It's public, it's specific, and is directed at a named agency or manufacturer. Ignoring it means the next time this happens, you're on the record as having been told.
The moral pressure is the enforcement mechanism.
And it works more often than you'd think. The FAA adopts many NTSB recommendations as formal regulations. A manufacturer will issue a service bulletin. An airline will change a training program. The recommendation is the seed. The regulation is the tree.
Runway overrun specifically. This has been a focus area for how long?
Decades. The NTSB has had runway excursions on its most wanted list repeatedly. The recommendation that comes up again and again is the engineered materials arresting system. It's a bed of crushable concrete at the end of the runway. An aircraft that overruns sinks into it and stops. The FAA has installed them at some airports, but not all. Cost is the issue. A full EMAS installation is millions per runway end. And the airports that need it most are often the ones with the least room, which makes the construction harder.
So the Miami overrun will be compared against a stack of prior overruns, where the NTSB already recommended exactly this kind of intervention.
And the report will likely say something like, had an EMAS been installed, the aircraft would have stopped within the runway safety area. Or it'll say the overrun was within the area that didn't require it. Either way, the recommendation history is part of the analysis. That's the institutional memory working.
What about the near-miss side? Daniel mentioned that near-misses get the same rigor.
The Aviation Safety Reporting System, ASRS. It's voluntary and confidential. A pilot or controller files a report about something that almost went wrong, a runway incursion that was caught at the last second, a misheard clearance, a maintenance issue discovered in flight. The report goes to NASA, which administers it, not the FAA. The reporter gets immunity from enforcement if the report was filed properly and wasn't deliberate misconduct. That immunity is what makes the system work. If reporting a near miss got you fired or violated, nobody would report.
So you trade punishment for information.
The information is gold. ASRS has millions of reports. Analysts mine it for patterns. A near miss at one airport that looks like a one-off is actually the 97th time that same confusion has happened at that same intersection. The system catches problems before they become accidents. That's the proactive side, and it's as important as the accident investigation side.
The global dimension. A crash in Indonesia teaches a lesson to a pilot in Kansas. How does that actually travel?
ICAO. The International Civil Aviation Organization. It sets global standards for accident investigation under what's called Annex 13. The standard says investigation is for prevention, not blame. It says the state where the accident happened leads the investigation, but the state where the aircraft was manufactured and the state where it was registered participate. It says the final report must be made public. That last part is crucial. The report isn't proprietary. It isn't sealed. It's published for the world.
The black box data is useless if the findings aren't shared. The sharing is the actual safety system.
The sharing works because the industry is small and the stakes are shared. A flaw found in a Boeing aircraft in one country is a flaw in every Boeing aircraft in every country. The airlines have a collective interest in the truth. That's rare. Car companies don't share crash data the way airlines share accident reports.
The limitations, though. This isn't a frictionless machine.
Far from it. Recommendations can sit for years. The NTSB has a list of open recommendations that are decades old. The FAA moves slowly, partly because rulemaking is complex, partly because there's political pressure. Retrofitting an entire fleet is expensive, and the airlines push back. There have been cases where a recommendation was issued, ignored, and then the same accident happened again.
The political pressure can cut both ways. An investigation in a country where the national airline is a point of pride might not be as independent as the ICAO standard assumes.
That's a real problem. The system is only as good as the independence of the investigating body. In countries where the regulator and the airline are the same government, the rapport can be compromised. The international community pushes back, but it can't force transparency. The black box data is only as good as the honesty of the people reading it.
We have the history, the data, the pipeline, the limitations. The Miami investigation will follow this exact path. Recorders recovered, data downloaded, timeline reconstructed, probable cause determined, recommendations issued.
The report will land in 18 months or 2 years. The NTSB takes its time because the report has to be right. The Miami overrun will be a data point in a long argument about runway safety areas and stopping margins. The report won't be a headline. It'll be a document, and the document will change something.
The report isn't the product. The change is the product.
Which is the thing most people miss. The NTSB report isn't the end of the story. It's the beginning of the next chapter. The recommendation goes out, the FAA drafts a rule, the manufacturers redesign a component, the airlines retrain their crews. The crash becomes a curriculum.
The curriculum is written in the blood of the people who didn't survive. That's the gravity underneath all of this. The rigor exists because the cost of being wrong is measured in bodies.
The Miami overrun, nobody died. That's a gift, in a grim way. It means the investigators get a full data set and a full aircraft and a full crew to interview. The lessons will be extracted without a funeral. Most accident investigations aren't that lucky.
Let's talk about what the recorders actually sound like when you listen to them. Because Daniel asked what investigators turn over, and the data is one thing, but the human layer is another.
The CVR is the hardest evidence to work with. The FDR is clean. Numbers. The CVR is two people doing a job, and then something goes wrong, and you hear it. The NTSB has strict rules about how the audio is handled. It isn't released publicly. A transcript is prepared, and even the transcript is carefully redacted. The pilots' families get to hear it first in some cases.
The investigators are listening to the last minutes of someone's life as part of their job.
They do it with a kind of clinical detachment that's both necessary and slightly unsettling. You're listening for specific call-outs, for checklist items, for the sound of a warning horn. You aren't listening as a person. You're listening as an instrument. But the person is still there.
The mundane parts. That's what gets me. The CVR isn't all crisis. It's 2 hours of mostly normal conversation. What they had for dinner, a complaint about the schedule, a joke about a gate agent.
Then the last 90 seconds are the crisis. The investigators have to hold both, the banality and the catastrophe. The banality is actually useful, because it tells you whether the crew was alert, whether they were distracted, whether they were fatigued. A crew that's chatting normally 30 seconds before an event is a crew that didn't see it coming. That's a data point.
I used to transcribe those tapes.
Wait. You did what?
Late 90s. Small regional carrier out of Pittsburgh. I was the data analyst, which meant I did everything nobody else wanted to do. After any incident, even a hard landing, the CVR tape went to a lab, but we had to prepare a transcript first. I'd sit in a room with headphones and a foot pedal and type out every word.
That's a very specific job to fall into.
It paid $11 an hour, and I was 23. The thing about the tapes is they're mostly nothing. Two guys talking about a restaurant in Cleveland, a captain complaining about the new scheduling software, a first officer trying to remember a movie title. And then there's the moment where the tone changes. You can hear it before any alarm goes off. The conversation just stops.
The silence is the signal.
The silence is the signal. I transcribed one where they were talking about a steakhouse. The captain said the ribeye was overrated. The first officer said the one in Columbus was better. And then there was a wind shear alert, and the captain said something I won't repeat, and then it was all checklist callouts and the sound of the aircraft fighting the air. They landed fine. Nobody got hurt. But the transcript went from steakhouse to survival in 4 seconds.
That's the part the data alone can't capture. The FDR shows the wind shear. The CVR shows that they were completely unready for it because they were mid-sentence about dinner.
The investigators treated the steakhouse part as evidence, not as noise. They wanted to know if the crew was distracted, if the conversation was a sign of complacency, but the senior investigator told me something I still think about. He said the steakhouse part is what makes the rest of it true. If the tape was just checklists and callouts, it wouldn't be a cockpit, it'd be a simulation. The mundane parts prove you're listening to real people doing a real job.
The banality isn't noise. It's the baseline. It's what normal looks like, and the crisis is measured against it.
That's what he said. And he was right. The hardest part of that job wasn't the crashes. It was the near misses, the tapes where they almost died and then had to fly the rest of a leg. You'd hear the first officer's voice shaking for the next 20 minutes. The captain would try to sound calm. Nobody talked about the steakhouse after that.
The near-miss data is the same way. An ASRS report isn't just facts. It's a pilot writing down the scariest moment of their career in the hope that someone else doesn't have to live it.
I did that job for 14 months. Then the airline went under and I went to work for a company that made industrial scales. But I still think about the tapes. The way a voice changes when the person speaking it realizes the aircraft isn't going to do what they want it to do.
That moment is what the whole system is built to prevent.
The system is good, but the system is made of people listening to other people's last words. That part never gets easier.
This is the thing I keep coming back to. The investigation is forensic, but the raw material is human. The FDR gives you the physics, the CVR gives you the experience, and the report has to hold both. If you strip out the human layer, you miss the training gaps and the fatigue issues and the decision-making under pressure. If you strip out the technical layer, you miss the design flaws and the maintenance failures. The probable cause is always both.
The pipeline from finding to rule change has to translate both. A technical fix for a technical flaw. A training fix for a human flaw. The Miami report will probably have both. A recommendation about runway safety areas, and a recommendation about approach procedures in wet conditions.
The next frontier is the part that worries me a little. As aircraft become more automated, the FDR is recording the actions of a machine, not just a pilot. The autopilot's decisions, the autothrottle's adjustments, the flight management computer's logic, the investigation becomes an audit of software. And the CVR becomes less useful, because the pilots are monitoring rather than flying. The black box is increasingly a record of machine behavior.
The question becomes whether we're investigating a human error or a machine logic error. And the machine can't explain itself.
That's the open question. The industry is moving toward predictive safety, using data from millions of normal flights to spot patterns that precede accidents, a certain combination of parameters that shows up before a hard landing. A subtle degradation in a sensor that correlates with a later failure. The idea is to intervene before the accident, not after. That's the next generation.
The Miami overrun will feed that system. Every overrun feeds the dataset. The more we know about how overruns happen, the better the predictive models get.
The better the arresting systems get, and the better the training gets. The report is one document, but it enters a living system. The system learns.
Daniel's question was about the pipeline, and the pipeline ends where it began. A crash happens, a team investigates, a report is written, a recommendation is issued, a rule is adopted, a design is changed, a training program is updated. And then the next flight takes off with all of that work underneath it.
The passenger never sees any of it. They see a safety card and a seatbelt demonstration. They don't see the decades of accumulated lessons that made the seatbelt demonstration the only thing they need to worry about.
The rigor is invisible. That's the point. The system works so well that it looks like nothing is happening.
The Miami investigation will be invisible too until the report lands. Then it'll be a footnote. Then it'll be a rule change. Then it'll be forgotten. And then it'll save someone's life and nobody will ever know.
That's the whole job. Preventing the tragedy that doesn't happen.
We should thank our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. And for the foot pedal work, apparently.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to us.
show my weird prompts where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.